From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Here's a listener favorite from 2008.
I'm Farai Chidea. Every day at the Olympics, someone enters the history books. Last Sunday, the U.S. men's swim team tore up the 4x100-meter freestyle relay, earning them a gold medal and a world record. Cullen Jones swam the third leg of the race, and he made history in another way. He's only the second African-American to get a gold medal in swimming. Later in the show, we'll get a briefing on the Olympics with Tony Cox and Bill Roden. But now we have Cullen Jones with us speaking from the Olympics in Beijing. Hey, Cullen.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
So how's Beijing treating you? And more importantly, how do you feel right now having gotten a gold?
I'm on cloud nine since I've gotten the gold. Beijing has been absolutely amazing. It's a great venue. The pool is fast. The city completely lights up, and everyone that's here is just really excited about hosting the Olympics, and it's a great environment.
So this is really the culmination of years of hard work. And let's go back in time. How did you and why did you get into swimming as a child?
As a child, I was originally doing basketball and gymnastics, and I went to a swim meet with one of my friends just to support her, and my mom always called me a water baby, and I loved watching kids diving in and being competitive in the water. That's exactly what I wanted to do, and I looked at my mom and I said, you know, since I couldn't do gymnastics because I was going to be too tall, they were telling me I had to stop. It's like, I'd love to start swimming. And my mom said, well, you're going to have to see it until the end. And I'm like, all right, well, I can do that. And we've just been going since. I've been setting goals and trying to break them ever since that.
You also had a really tough experience in the water. Can you tell us a little bit about that when you were a kid?
Sure. When I was 5 years old, I almost drowned at an amusement park. It was Dorney Park in Philadelphia. There was an inner tube ride that my dad wanted to get on, and he was my hero at the time. And I was like, yes, I'd love to get on the inner tube. Yeah, well, let's do it. My mom felt that I was going to be a little too small for it, but we convinced her that it would be okay. And after waiting a long line to get up to the top, my dad went first, and he made me promise that I wouldn't let go of the inner tube. And I said, yeah, Dad, I'll do it. Sure, not a problem. Well, he went down first, and I heard him screaming the whole way down, which made me a little nervous. But when I went down, I did exactly what he told me. I held on as tight as I could. But when I hit the pool of water at the bottom of the inner tube ride, I ended up flipping upside down and holding on upside down underwater. And unfortunately, I ended up passing out, and I had the whole procedure done. I had CPR done, resuscitation. And I came back, and I was like, yeah, what's next? You know, it didn't even faze me. But until later, when I started telling the story, that I could have died that day.
It strikes me that you must be fearless in more ways than one, because in order to compete at this level, I assume you have to be brave. You have to be willing to step out on faith. So what do you do to prep before you go out and swim?
One of the things that my coach used to tell me is that, you know, the hard part's over when you're at a swim meet. You've done all the practicing. You've done all the training. I wouldn't say fearless. I'm usually pretty nervous before I swim any event, even if I feel like I'm going to win. And on Sunday, it was no different. I was shaking behind the blocks. I was so nervous. It was my first Olympics, and I wanted to really perform well because I had three other guys that were kind of depending on me to swim fast. But all the preparation, all the training that I've done prepared me for it.
If you had to rate your performance in the relay on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you think you did that day?
That day, I'm a very hard critic on myself, so I would never give myself a 10 because being a sprinter, we strive for perfection because it's such a short amount of meters to go. I would give myself probably about an 8. It was a fast swim, but I can always go back and try to get faster.
We have seen, most of us have seen on television or online, these images of the opening ceremonies and the pageantry that is going on in Beijing right now. From an athlete's perspective, what was the most interesting or impressive moment that you've had on the ground? It doesn't have to be a big ceremony, but what let you know, wow, I'm here in Beijing and I'm at the Olympics and, you know, I'm in the moment?
It was definitely when the meet started, once the races were starting to go, and I was watching the fans come in, and I was standing on deck right before they closed it off so that the press would come in and the cameras would come in to film the race. And the amount of people that were in the stands, I was just like, wow, okay, I've got to get ready for this. I am at the Olympics. This is the real deal. And definitely when I came outside after the finals, the whole city just lights up because the venues are so close together. They have the water queue lighting up, changing different colors, the bird's nest with the flame. It was just really, really a great moment for me looking around and just seeing how much effort they put into the Olympics. I was just so ready and so inspired by it.
Now, you are someone, based not just on the incident that you had nearly drowning back when you were five, but on other levels, who really has dealt with the issue of African Americans and swimming. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in terms of how many African Americans do and don't swim and your perspective on that.
It really didn't hit me until I became a professional, and I was given by USA Swimming the statistics on minorities in swimming, and I was just devastated to see that minorities, black and Hispanic, are almost three times more likely to drown than their counterparts. And, you know, to think back at my story of when I was five, I could have easily been added to the number. And it's kind of ironic that now I'm a gold medalist and I'm in the position and in the seat to try to fix and try to help diversity in the sport, not only trying to do that, but also trying to get more kids interested in water safety and getting them into the pool. I'm working on trying to get a tour together where I'll be going around teaching some clinics and having swim meets for those that are already competitive. Just to get them aware and get them exposed to the life of swimming and USA Swimming. And it was really great that after I got the gold medal, one of my sponsors, Bank of America, ended up giving me $10,000 to jumpstart that movement, which was actually really great. I was completely shocked. I didn't expect it at all, but it's a great start.
So you're going to be doing clinics. What ages of kids do you think that you're going to work with or want to work with?
Well, before the Olympics, my plan was to work with kids that were already exposed to the sport. So I was open to any age, and I still am open to any age. I think that with the gold medal, I think I can reach a wider range of participants, hopefully younger, that are thinking about choosing a sport. I'm definitely not trying to find the next Michael Phelps, but get kids to understand the importance of safety around the water and around the pool.
You actually swam with some of the people who have been on your Olympic team before at the Pan Pacific Championships. What's the teamwork aspect like of what you do?
One of the things that we have always felt is that we are a team from the beginning of the meet. It is a very individualized sport, but we put most of our focus into team, all of our efforts equal into a team, especially when you're on a relay. That's when really you really get that that team atmosphere. And one of the things that Jason Lezak said to us right before, on Sunday before the 4x100 relay, is that we're swimming a 400 free relay, not a 4x100 free relay. We're one team, we're a family. And that just gets you really pumped up that you're a part of something so big, and it definitely helps that it says USA and I'm trying to support my country.
How does that play out, the issue of nationality? And what I mean by that is that I'm sure all of the athletes have certain things in common. You're all there as top-notch competitors coming from around the world, but at the same time, you're also representing for your nation. So is the atmosphere with athletes from other countries friendly, tense, rivalry-laden? What's it like?
I think it just depends on the team itself. We are looked at as being very dominant in the swimming community. the U.S. is very, very competitive. Our trials, our Olympic trials, is actually faster than some of the other events that have taken place at the at the Olympics. So we are kind of looked at as being very dominant. And whenever there's a team that's close to us in an event, like the French team in the 4x100 relay, sometimes there's a little competitiveness that comes out. But for the most part, we're still friends. I'm friends with two of the guys that are actually on the French team. And it's just some friendly rivalry. But, you know, a lot of people take it too far and say, you know, they said they're going to do this, they said they're going to do that. And we understand that it's rivalry, so we don't really go back and say anything. But sometimes you have to deal with it, definitely.
What about the issues of Tibet and Darfur? There have been a lot of conflicts about whether or not athletes should even talk about China and human rights, and there's been all this back and forth. What are the conversations like among athletes? Are athletes talking about those issues in general? And I don't mean even necessarily to the media and to the public, but amongst themselves.
Athletes are really not speaking out on it, really, just because we're not spokespeople for causes besides our own. We train, and I myself really just put my head in the dirt for the most part, because I'm training so hard and I'm paying so much attention to the lifestyle that I live, what I'm eating, making sure that I'm at practice on time. I mean, for the most part, athletes are here to compete, and we are so focused in on that's all that we really have time to think about.
Again, Cullen, thanks so much. Cullen Jones is a swimmer for the U.S. team. He just won a gold medal as part of the U.S. men's 4x100-meter freestyle relay, and he spoke to us from the Olympic Games in Beijing, China.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Here's another listener favorite from 2008.
Dizzy Gillespie is considered to be the first musician to fuse jazz with Afro-Cuban and Latin rhythms. More than five decades later, Latin jazz is more popular than ever, and the genre is constantly evolving. As we continue our month-long series on jazz, we bring you a look at Latin jazz. With us, Jose Rizzo. He's the music director for the Southern California radio station KKJZ. He hosts the show Jazz on the Latin Side. He's also the band leader of the 15-piece big band, the Jazz on the Latin Side All-Stars. We're also joined by band leader and percussionist Pancho Sanchez. He's released more than 23 albums, including his latest, Raise Your Hand. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, Jose, let me start with you. How did Latin jazz come to be?
Well, it started back in the 40s, in the mid-40s. And if there's a seed for Latin jazz, I would have to say it would be Mario Bauza, because he brought in the jazz harmonies into Machito's Latin band. And then later he was also very close with Dizzy Gillespie, and he was more of a mentor for Dizzy. And when Dizzy saw what his mentor was doing with the Latin jazz stuff, Dizzy wanted something like that in his band as well.
I mean, we're going to get to a whole bunch of music. And I just want to say that we have so much music that we've queued up. I'm going to go in order of what we have, but we're not going to get to.
No, there's no way.
We're not going to get to hardly anything. Let's start with Tito Puente. Let's first take a listen. Hi, Pancho, I think that most people will know that song, whether or not they know a lot about Tito Puente. I was so pleased to be able to see him at an arts festival. What's his significance in this genre?
Well, you know, Tito was a very good friend of mine. As a matter of fact, my son that's standing outside in the hallway there, his name is Tito. I named him after Tito Puente. That's how close I was with Tito. Tito was guest with my band many times. I was guest with his band many times. And Tito plays a great role in the Latin music scene and also the Latin jazz scene. The thing about this tune, we just heard a clip of a piece of, is Oye Como Va. I remember when a friend came to my home when I was in high school, and they brought me the Santana recording of Oye Como Va. He said, there's a new song out called Oye Como Va by Carlos Santana. And he put it on for me, and I said, so you think that's new, huh? And I took out one of my old records, and I put the original Tito Puente. I says, that song was recorded 14 years before that. And he goes, oh, that guy copied Santana, huh? I said,
oh, no.
The other way around.
Now, go ahead.
Yeah, and Tito, you know, he didn't like that version of Oye Como Va. He told me the story, too. And then one day he opened his mailbox and he got this check in the mail.
That's right.
He looked at it, and Tito goes, this is my favorite version of Oye Como Va from Carlos Santana.
Yeah,
that's right.
Gotta love those royalties.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pancho, tell me about some of the other artists who influenced your music early in your career.
Well, for me, we were started at the beginning with Dizzy Gillespie and Chano Poza. Mario Bowles introduced them together, and Jose touched upon that. Of course, the great Mongo Santa Maria, who I named my other son after. I have a son also named Mongo. And Mongo was a very good friend of mine and also was a guest many times with my band and vice versa. And Mongo's on one of my CDs entitled Conga Blue that we dedicated to Mongo. Mongo played with us on it. So I would say the great Mongo Santa Maria, conga drummer, and of course the late great Cal Jader, who I spent 7.5 years with touring the world, and I won a Grammy with Cal Jader in 1980.
Let's listen to a little bit of him. Jose, when you choose what to play, how do you choose what to play, given the variety of what we've already heard?
Well, when I first started doing radio on K-Jazz, it was almost 20 years ago. And Latin jazz was still not something that people would pin down, like this is what Latin jazz is. So I did a lot of searching, a lot of exploring. And I just kind of discovered this range that I kind of tap into, you know, from head-on jazz musicians. In fact, I discovered a lot of music that straight-ahead jazz musicians were doing that they didn't realize they were doing as far as that could fit under the Latin jazz category, Sonny Rollins and Eddie Lockjaw Davis. So I really got deep into what the great jazz musicians were already doing.
One of the things we talk about on our show is ethnicity, whether it's African ethnicity, the ethnicity of immigrants into the African-American culture, Latino ethnicity. And of course, there are people from so many parts of the world who may be who may put themselves under the umbrella of Latino. Mm-hmm. Where do you think this music comes from in terms of the influences of region that end up in this?
Well, in every region, the music is expressed in different ways, you know. And I think now it's beyond really cultures and ethnicity. I mean, the fact that Dizzy Gillespie was one of the creators of this music and Cal Jader was one of the proponents that really influenced so many people into listening to Latin jazz, and none of them are Latino, you know.
That's right. Cal was a Swedish descent, you know, and Jose is absolutely correct. Nowadays, there's so many different types of people that are involved in Latin jazz now. But one thing I'm very, very proud of is that Latin jazz is mine and yours. If you were born in the United States of America, this is our music. This is American music. Latin jazz was born in New York City by the great Dizzy Gillespie, the great jazz trumpet player, and when he met the great Cuban conga drummer, dancer, and composer, Chano Poza, when they met in about 1945 or something like that, that's when they met. That's when Latin jazz came alive, right here in the United States of America. So I'm proud to say it's ours. You know?
It is our music. And Dizzy Gillespie, you know, being so fond of Mario Bauza, his mentor, he would go see the Machito Orchestra.
That's
and
right.
Dizzy would say, hey, Mario, can you give me one of those tom-tom players?
Yeah,
he
called him
he didn't know what to call player. Him, so he called him a tom-tom player. Can I get a tom-tom player?
Instead of a conga drummer, you know? A tom-tom is like a drum. You know?
Right, right. Totally different.
And Mario Bausa brought Chano Pozo, and that's when it started on the jazz end.
That's right.
Well, in case you are just joining us midway, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This is part of our month-long series on jazz, and we're talking today about Latin jazz with Jose Rizzo, music director for the Southern California radio station KKJZ. He also hosts their show Jazz on the Latin Side, plus band leader and percussionist Pancho Sanchez. And Pancho, you've got a CD, Out of Sight. It's a tribute to one of your heroes, James Brown. Ray Charles and Billy Preston sing One Mint Julep on the CD. You put a Latin twist on the song. Let's take a listen. Well, this is actually, you know, always radio is an art form, and we actually play the wrong song. So first of all, tell us what we're listening to.
That tune's called Saints and Sinners, written by David Torres, my musical director in the band, and that's David playing organ and piano on there. Saints and Sinners, but it's cool. That's pretty close.
At least it's yours.
Yeah, that's right.
They were in the studio together.
Yeah, that's right. They're together. You know what I mean? But One Mint Julep is a tune that, of course, was made very popular by, in the '60s by Ray Charles himself, and Ray's on here, and the great Billy Preston on organ.
Well, you know what? We have the song now. Let's hear it. So what do you like about that song? And obviously, you know, you must like it, but specifically, what do you like about that song, its rhythms, et cetera?
Well, you know, that tune, when I was a kid, I would hear Ray Charles, I would hear that on the radio, on the record player, and I always loved that tune because it was very happy, you know, and it's got a good groove. And Ray did it as a cha-cha, but I don't think he really knew he was doing it exactly like a cha-cha-cha, you know, because his was a little different. And I said, man, that lends itself perfectly to the cha-cha-cha rhythm, you know. And, of course, the cha-cha-cha is a dance and a rhythm. And so, and it's got the blues feel to
That's
it.
Right. All
and
the elements.
All that stuff together. I mean, to me, that is Latin jazz and that is our American music. And then Billy Preston, who they call the fifth Beatle, Billy came in to play the organ on that with us. And then Ray overdubbed his voice in the center. You could hear Ray in the center here talking with us. And he also recorded another song with us, Marianne.
And that's something that Poncho has brought to the world of Latin jazz, that R&B influence. Willie Bobo and Mongo did it a little bit back in the 60s and 70s. And Poncho just took on a whole new personality in combining those elements. In fact, he even took the New Orleans sound with the harmonica and all that and the singing and brought Latin jazz and, you know, kind of fused it with Latin jazz. So he's having a good time, putting his own voice, his own stamp on Latin jazz.
It's clear that both of you are having a good time. And Jose, a little bit later, we're going to hear some of your work. But, you know, in addition to this being an American music, you've talked a little bit so far about how it's popular in Europe. And, I hope I get his name right. Sebastian Schunke.
Yeah,
let's hear a little bit of him. Now, what do you like about this music, and what do you hear when you hear it?
Well, Sebastian Schunke added also a classical element to Latin jazz, and there's some parts where he goes off more into a classical direction, and it's more like orchestral, and he puts a lot of elements, a lot of progressive jazz that's used in it. And a lot of European players and people in South America, they're listening to the Latin jazz from the U.S., but they're as well adding their own special elements of their region, of their culture, and creating just something new, just the music evolving.
Pancho, when you look out in the audience, I'm sure you see a lot of different types of audiences, but what's your connection with the audience when you play?
Well, it's just the music itself that we play, the feel that you get from the music. You know, we just were in Europe. We were in Istanbul, Turkey. We were in Finland. And, you know, we tour every couple of years to Europe and Japan and like that. And, of course, a lot of people don't even understand what we're saying. You know, they don't speak English or they don't speak Spanish because we also sing salsa music in Spanish. But they feel the music, and so that's what the connection is. And, you know, it doesn't take but one or two songs. And in a concert, people usually start dancing, and they'll get in a corner in the aisles and start dancing. So it's just the feel, the warmth of the music and the feel of the music.
You know, in doing this series, there's we've talked a little bit about jazz radio and how jazz radio can sometimes be difficult to find for listeners. What's your sense of the state of jazz radio?
Jazz radio, for some reason, always has had a very selective audience. It just always has been that way. And jazz stations have always just tried to just survive. There are no more commercial jazz stations. Those are gone. Yeah, they're dinosaurs. But now there are the jazz survived in public radio. And now there are only less than a handful of full-time jazz stations in the whole country.
Yeah.
And so that's why the few that are left are really supported very heavily by its members, like here K-Jazz here and WBGO in New York City, yeah. Well, in New Jersey, in the New York area. So it's something that – and then the interesting thing about us here on the West Coast, we're trying different things. We have now Latin jazz during drive time every day, mm-hmm. 5 to 7 p.m. on K-Jazz, and that's one of the highest-rated programs on the jazz station. One of the few jazz stations left in the country, probably one of the two top in the whole country, and people love listening to Latin jazz during drive time. So, you know, again, jazz radio is also evolving.
You know, the only other station also I could think in Denver, Colorado,
right.
There's a station there, Cubo. They were doing Latin jazz every third song. But actually, I think they've changed that policy now. But it is a jazz station, and Carlos Lando, our good friend there, runs the stations over there.
You know, one of the things that strikes us is that there's a question of jazz education. Do you think that there needs to be a little bit more of an outreach to people to educate them? And if so, how do you do that?
Well, for me, I've done what I do when I play universities and colleges and schools all over the country is they usually line up clinics that we do before we play the concert. So I've done many question and answer periods and clinics with my group. I also have a book, How to Learn to Play the Basic Fundamentals of Latin Music, Poncho Sanchez book, and instructional DVD. So, yeah, of course, and then there's a lot of stuff on the internet nowadays, but very important to get more into the universities and the colleges of our music here.
I want to play a little bit of Sexto Sentido. It's a bit of your music, Jose.
Yes, four young ladies from Cuba, more going in the direction of the band Take Six, a four-way, beautifully harmonic vocal group.
Quiero navegar contigo por un mar infinito y llegar a esa tierra donde todo está.
So why did you decide to work on something with this feel?
Because there's jazz in there. There's jazz harmonies. And, I mean, it's like listening to Take Six, but it's in Spanish, you know? And I thought it's good to expand jazz radio even further by introducing this to you know, our jazz audience. And they've been responding pretty well. And this group is very excited in Cuba. They found out we're playing their music. They even send us an ID, you know, singing about the station and my radio program, Jazz on the Latin Side. So we're making connections.
Well, we have packed in an awful lot in a short amount of time. I want to thank you both so much for your time. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
We've been speaking with Grammy Award-winning percussionist and band leader Pancho Sanchez. His latest album is Raise Your Hand, and Jose Rizzo, music director for Southern California radio station KKJZ. He also hosts their show Jazz on the Latin Side. Both were with me at our NPR West studios. You can watch a video of this interview on our blog. Just go to nprnewsandviews.org. And finally, we leave you with a song from Jose's band Jazz on the Latin Side All-Stars. The group group CD is called Tambolero.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Here's another listener favorite from 2008.
Some people call it meta rap or hipster rap, and now some people are also heralding this as the renaissance of hip-hop. Mainstream rap continues to weave street life millionaire fantasies, but this new crop of MCs is creating a sound reminiscent of the early days of hip-hop. With us to break down the new sound is Harry Allen, a hip-hop veteran who's written about the genre for Vibe, Spin, and The Source. He also runs the website Media Assassin at harryallen.info. We also have with us Noah Callahan Bever, the editor-in-chief of The Complex magazine. We've also got Alvin Lindsay, better known as Ra El Milio. He's half of the hip-hop duo The Nux. Thanks for joining me, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start with you, Ra. How would you describe the music that you put out? And we'll listen to a little bit of it in a second.
It's a collection of different sounds all into a hip-hop nutshell. Because me and my brother, we dabble in different genres. We bend them a little bit, twist them, dabble into them, you know. But it's staying true to real hip-hop, you know.
All right, here's a little bit of one of your songs, Bang Bang.
When the gun goes bang, 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 who's gonna know the one? No, nobody knows. When the gun goes bang, 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 who's gonna know the one? No, nobody knows.
Yo,
the one.
Taking it back to 94 when was selling the finally sold, cracked and hit and it up and baby gangs was full of them pluck. Pluck the feathers up off a duck. You stuck like Chuck, you carried a battle. Pistol play, your knuckle up. Then better to tatter the children of scatter. Everyone knows, don't f*** with them hoes. Tweaking with Keisha from out there, yo. Full of that dilly pop is silly when first heard the chopper city. And I was a dancing b-boy who resorted to slanging them e-boys and jacking them cars, macking them bras, statistic f***ed and flipped the script.
So who's the audience for a group like The Nux?
Well, I mean, I think that, Nux have a very broad base audience. Everything from sort of the most hardcore hip-hop purist all the way to a fairly broad, you know, crossover mainstream audience. These are the people whose big brothers grew up listening to 50 Cent or Snoop Dogg and that type of thing. So this is sort of, you know, almost their rebellion from those archetypes of what hip-hop is supposed to be.
Harry, I also heard a little bit of Outkast in there, just in the sense of like this maniacally happy Southern thing going on. That's an Atlanta situation, not New Orleans. But what do you hear when you listen to the music?
Well, I mean, what I hear, first of all, is their youth and their willingness to try something that doesn't sound like what we've been hearing for a little while now. I also hear the way hip-hop has come to mean different things for different people over the spread of time, that hip-hop is really something that started as sort of a unitary idea, and that over time it's been like a tree that's branches have gone in so many different directions and have maybe even put down other trees.
So what are we headed for? Are we headed for a dissolution of hip-hop as we know it? I mean, are we going to see a movement away from mega, mega, mega hip-hop into, you know, what you call branches, or you could call maybe shards or you know, little tiny fragments?
You can only do one thing over and over again, you know, before people become tired of it. And so what you're seeing is groups like the Nux coming and sort of, you know, as Ra was saying, applying the sort of cultural aesthetic of hip-hop onto these other different sort of forms.
We frame this a little bit in the case of a return to the basics, a return to the early days of hip-hop, but it sounds to me like this is a more forward-looking blend. Noah, is what do you think about that? I mean, is this something that really is more music that relies on looking back or looking forward?
Well, I mean, I think it definitely looks forward. I think if you look at it, you know, using the Nux, for example, it's like what they're doing, the fact that these are two brothers from New Orleans that went to the same high school as Lil Wayne, yet they made an album where they produced the entire record themselves, wrote all the songs, played every instrument on the record. And, you know, when you listen to it, it sounds like a Saturday night on Sunset Boulevard, which is exactly where they were when they were recording it. But still, you know, there's still like the chant raps from the early 90s on there and references to the Fat Boys, stick 'em, ha ha ha, stick 'em, on the choruses. So you're still seeing an adherence to the traditions of hip hop, but I think that they're breaking new ground in general. There's been an encouragement for everyone to sort of explore the artistic side, because really, if you look at the home runs that have been hit in every genre in the last 2 to 3 years, you know, it's been you know, the Kanye Wests, the people that take the chances and do something that's outside of the box.
There's another band that the Nux are touring with right now called the Cool Kids, and here's a little bit of their track, Delivery Man.
I never had a stain on my shirt. I'm flying, so I'm flying, needle clean in the dirt. I got the works. I work the full shift full of work. Not work, work, but I shove boxes of hotness. Don't drop it, materials of value in them boxes. Don't box me, Sugar Ray Leonard to them boxes. Watch me, not watch them, I'm like clockwork. Charles got a flavor, flake clock on his shirt. And it tick tock, tick, let it work. Pick mine, get twist mine, jack, it'll work. I got a smiley face, have a nice day t-shirt. Mikey said you should wear it.
Harry, who are the Cool Kids?
They're a group of young artists who are reproducing, if you will, a look, first of all, that's very strongly reminiscent of hip-hop as it was in the mid-80s, I guess you could say, or probably around the time most of them were born or slightly before, maybe, doing music that's evocative of that time period in a certain way, in terms of arrangements, some of the sounds, the timbres of the samples or the sources that they're quoting. You know, I think there's a real rush, and I've seen this before, a rush to declare a scene, to say that there is a scene, you know. It's called meta rap. I remember there was a rush to declare one form alternative rap. I remember Me-Fi Me in the early 90s. Everyone wanted to say, oh, alternative rap is now the thing. I think what we're seeing here are quite a few trends kind of cresting together. We're seeing, one, artists who have all lived in the age of hip-hop's success. These are people who were born not only after hip-hop became a form, but after it was popular, after it was already something people knew about and were, and when artists were already selling platinum. So they've never, the Bambaataa and even P.E. Or Run-DMC, you know, Run-DMC's Sucker MCs was released 25 years ago this year. So that would have been, at the time, a lot of people, I'm sure even Noah, I don't know if you remember when Sucker MCs came out, you would have been four, I guess, you know. But for some of us, those were kind of the records that dominated our youth or our introduction to the culture. What is the size of the hip-hop universe, maybe? Or what is the rate at which hip-hop refreshes itself? You know, physicists say that if you stood on a planet and shot an arrow far enough and hard enough in one direction, the universe is closed, and what would actually happen is the arrow would come back and hit you in the back of the head if you had enough time. So I'm kind of wondering, does hip-hop have a refresh rate where after a certain amount of time of
only you, Harry Allen,
kind of music,
can say that.
Do you have to go back and start over, kind of, and use that as your fertilizer, as your soil, and start over? And then what does that produce?
I mean, I think that if you look at all of the people that were making music in that early period, whether it was Bambaataa or Run-DMC or Rick Rubin, all of them were taking all of their cues from outside rap, which is perhaps part of what made it so exciting when it was happening. And I think that what happened was between 1997 and 2006, you were seeing this incredible inbreeding in hip-hop where it was like people that had grown up listening to Tupac and Biggie, emulating Tupac and Biggie, and it was becoming more and more cartoonish. And I think you can look at 50 Cent as sort of like the hyperbolic expression of that inbreeding, because he was sort of the thug rapper with pop appeal at its sort of zenith. And I think that once you've achieved that, there's nowhere really to go from there. So, you know, what you have with these new groups is people that are now drawing from the outside to take things to the next place.
As opposed to going with a finally more crafted or bigger or more, you know, a rapper who's been shot 30 times. No, let's just pull from everything that's exploded over the last 30 years and recombinate it again and start over in a way. It's almost like bringing, we've got all the leftovers, so let's now make something out of the leftovers.
Well, I wouldn't call it leftovers, but I certainly would call it sampling. Let's listen to a little bit of the group Kid Sister. All right, Harry, do you think this is emulation, imitation, or adulation?
I think it sounds great. I mean, I think it's emulation and it's imitation. You know, it's almost like, in a way, like, it's almost like the commercialism that has dominated hip-hop and the kind of corporate machine of music kind of closed the door for a while on a whole lot of people in a whole lot of ways that people get into the music. And then as everything started to collapse a little bit, the economy, record sales, peer-to-peer file networks started making it easier to get music without buying it, et cetera, et cetera. Like, the door started to crack open, and everybody who'd been starved behind this iron door came out rushing with everything that they'd been working on all that time but couldn't get through the door because the door was closed. When you hear what DJs are saying, they're saying, we can't play records like these in the clubs, you know. But, I mean, that remains to be seen, I guess.
It's interesting because that reminds me very much of, if you look at like what happened in rock music around 2000, 2001, where you had groups like the White Stripes and the Strokes coming out, and essentially what they were doing was emulating garage band rock from, you know, the early 70s, where it was completely stripped down, you know, 3-4 person group. And, you know, and then you look at where Jack White is in 2008, you know, as a musician, and it's like...
Among other things, doing the... doing half of the honors for the new James Bond theme.
Yes. Right, yeah.
With Alicia Keys.
So you can extrapolate from there where the Nux and the Cool Kids and Kid Sister will be musically 10 years from now.
Yeah, it's almost like it raises the question, is this a phenomenon in hip-hop, or is there a meta template that has to do with the way popular music works in this culture, from going from insignificance to, you know, amphitheaters?
All right, I'm going to play one more clip from the Nux. It's called Fire.
Let's do it. You know I got the fire, yo. N-O-N-Y-T-C-A-L-Y. Way down in ATL, they smoking the truck. Do my thing in St. Louis, Chicago. Kick out, kick out. And you flip out, and you dip out, dip out. Tell them what it is.
Noah, your magazine, Complex, put on a whole digital mixtape online featuring some of the artists. Tell us who's on the compilation and kind of what you're looking for.
Well, it's the Nux, Cool Kids, Wale,
B.O.B.,
Charles Hamilton, Supreme, and then maybe two or three other groups in addition to that. It's so funny about this, as Harry was saying, you know, there's this need to put to sort of identify something as a scene. And if you listen to all three of those groups that you've just played, none of them actually make music that sounds like one another. But what they do have in common is sort of an aesthetic fashion sense. And, you know, Complex saw that, and so we decided to do a fashion story called The Leaders of the New Cool, which sort of highlighted the fact that all these guys, although they're being grouped together and dressed the same, they don't actually make similar music.
Harry, when you think about mixtapes, when you think about iTunes, all the different ways that people get music today, is that going to bring people who were more old school hip hop fans back into connection with people who are these new artists we've been talking about?
That's a great question. I think it really has to do, one, on how this works out socially. I think that, it's interesting to me because a lot of, it depends on what you mean, first of all, old school. Like, that word has shifted, and the line keeps moving as time goes on and as new generations are born. I mean, at one time, old school meant everyone before Run DMC. Now old school can mean everyone before Jay-Z. You know, it depends on who you're talking to. But I think it really depends on how these artists are encouraged to interact, how they actually see the past. That is to say, new artists, do they see the past as a place where dinosaurs went to be shot, or do they see it as a rich kind of area of discovery?
It's interesting you say that, just because I was thinking about this the other day, you know, when you were saying that the DJs were complaining that they can't play this in the club. And I feel like at a certain point, they're going to have to come to terms with this and figure out a way to make it work in the club. Because, I mean,
depending on what the people demand, yeah.
Jay-Z is about to be 40. And right. So the king of the clubs is 40. If you're 17, does that even make sense to you? Like, when I was 17, you know, rappers that had come out 3 years prior were crazy old school and completely irrelevant. And granted, you know, the sort of cycles of hip-hop were much quicker during the early and mid-90s. But, you know, I think that there is going to have to be a point where these new artists are embraced by sort of, you know, the mainstream architecture of the MTVs and the Clear Channels and the Radio Ones.
Harry, Noah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Harry Allen, hip-hop journalist. He runs the blog Media Assassin at harryallen.info. He was in our NPR studios in New York. We also had Noah Callahan-Bever, the editor-in-chief of The Complex magazine and complex.com. He also joined us in our NPR studios in New York.
That's our show for today. Thanks for being with us. Nicole Childers and Christabel Nciabwade produced the show. Sasha Woodruff and Zachary Slobig edit. And Sonata Lee Narciss is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg, Marcia Caldwell, the drive engineer. Our staff includes Farai Chidea, Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Bennett, Jeffrey Gardner, Devin Robbins, and Drew Tewksbury. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes is created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. And on Monday, creating 5 million green-collar jobs over 10 years. That was the president-elect's campaign promise. We'll hear from environmentalist and author Van Jones about how the green economy could revive our inner cities. I'm Tony Cox. This is News and Notes.